Attention listeners, mark your calendars for Colorado Gives Day on December 10th. Support AfterSight and give to the causes you care about. Go to coloradogivesday.org/organizations/AfterSight between now and December 10th to make your donation. Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Welcome to Colorado Business Digest, narrated by Michael Hesser, with sources including Colorado Business Journal, ColoradoBiz.com, and the Denver Gazette. Our first article is titled, Denver-based Four Point Resources Partners on $2 Billion Acquisition. Uinta Basin asset includes 126,000 net acres and production of 29,000 barrels of crude oil per day, dated November 14, 2024. Denver-based Four Point Resources, LLC, with partners Quantum Capital Group and Kayne Anderson, announced Thursday the signing of a purchase and sale agreement to acquire Ovintiv Inc.'s Uinta Basin assets in northeast Utah for $2 billion in cash. The asset includes 126,000 net acres and production of 29,000 barrels of crude oil per day. The opportunity to partner with Quantum and Kayne Anderson, two of the premier private equity firms in energy, will allow our team to immediately begin the work to grow production, cash flow, and create value on one of the highest quality inventory-rich assets in the lower 48, said George Solich, chairman and CEO of Four Point. Four Point Resources is a privately held acquisition, exploration, and production company. Eric Eichler, chief operating officer of Four Point, described the Uinta Basin as a unique combination of attributes that make it an exceptional asset, including several thousand feet of hydrocarbon-rich reservoirs, premium quality crude oil, and a long history of stakeholder alignment. A.J. Curana, co-president of Quantum, said that with the maturation of unconventional resource plays in the U.S., assets possessing multiple decades of high-returning undrilled inventory are rare. We look forward to working closely with Four Point and believe their proven execution capabilities will drive economic production growth on this asset and maximize value for the local community, as well as Quantum's investors, Curana said. Wells Fargo Securities, LLC, served as exclusive financial advisor to Four Point Resources. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A., provided financing, and Wells Fargo Securities, LLC, served as the sole bookrunner and lead arranger for the transaction. Vinson and Elkins, LLP, served as legal counsel to Four Point and Quantum. Latham and Watkins, LLP, acted as legal advisor to Kayne Anderson. Our next article is titled, New FDA Rules for TV Drug Ads, Simpler Language and No Distractions. Many companies looking beyond TV to social media. Dated November 14, 2024 by Matthew Perrone. Those ever-present TV drug ads showing patients hiking, biking, or enjoying a day at the beach could soon have a different look. New rules require drug makers to be clearer and more direct when explaining their medication's risks and side effects. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration spent more than 15 years crafting the guidelines, which are designed to do away with industry practices that downplay or distract viewers from risk information. Many companies have already adopted the rules, which become binding November 20. But while regulators were drafting them, a new trend emerged. Thousands of pharma influencers pushing drugs online with little oversight. A new bill in Congress would compel the FDA to more aggressively police such promotions on social media platforms. Some people become very attached to social media influencers and ascribe to them credibility that, in some cases, they don't deserve, said Tony Cox, professor emeritus of marketing at Indiana University. Still, TV remains the industry's primary advertising format, with over $4 billion spent in the past year, led by blockbuster drugs like weight loss treatment Wegovy, according to iSpot TV, which tracks ads. The new rules, which cover both TV and radio, instruct drug makers to use simple, consumer-friendly language when describing their drugs, without medical jargon, distracting visuals, or audio effects. A 2007 law directed the FDA to ensure that drug risk information appears in a clear, conspicuous, and neutral manner. FDA has always required that ads give a balanced picture of both benefits and risks, a requirement that gave rise to those long, rapid-fire lists of side effects parodied on shows like Saturday Night Live. But in the early 2000s, researchers began showing how companies could manipulate images and audio to de-emphasize safety information. In one example, a Duke University professor found that ads for the allergy drug Nasonex, which featured a buzzing bee voiced by Antonio Banderas, distracted viewers from listening to side effect information, making it harder to remember. Such overt tactics have largely disappeared from drug ads. In general, I would say the ads have gotten more complete and transparent, said Ruth Day, director of the Medical Cognition Lab at Duke University and author of the Nasonex study. The new rules are significant steps forward, Day said, but certain requirements could also open the door to new ways of downplaying risks. One requirement instructs companies to show on-screen text about side effects while the audio information plays. A 2001 FDA study found that combining text with audio increased recall and understanding. But the agency leaves it to companies to decide whether to display a few words or a full transcript. You often cannot put all of that on the screen and expect people to read and understand it, Day said. If you wanted to hide or decrease the likelihood of people remembering risk information, that could be the way to do it. Viewers tend to tune out long lists of warnings and other information, but experts who work with drug companies don't expect those lists to disappear. While the guidelines describe how the information should be presented, companies still decide the content. If you're a company and you're worried about possible FDA enforcement or product liability and other litigation, all your incentives are to say more, not less, said Terry Cope, a food and drug lawyer who advises companies. Experts also say the new rules will have little effect on the overall tone and appearance of ads. The most salient element of these ads are the visuals, and they are uniformly positive, said Cox. Even if the risk message is about, for instance, sudden heart failure, they're still showing someone diving into a swimming pool. The new rules come as Donald Trump's advisors began floating plans for the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., an anti-vaccine activist who has advised the president-elect, wants to eliminate TV drug ads. He and other industry critics point out that the U.S. and New Zealand are the only countries where prescription drugs can be promoted on TV. Even so, many companies are looking beyond TV and expanding into social media. They often partner with patient influencers who post about managing their conditions, new treatments, or navigating the health system. They're teaching people to live a good life with their disease, but then some of them are also paid to advertise and persuade, said Aaron Willis, who studies advertising and media at the University of Colorado Boulder. Advertising executives say companies like the format because it's cheaper than TV, and consumers generally feel influencers are more trustworthy than companies. FDA's requirement for truthful, balanced risk and benefit information applies to drug makers, leaving a loophole for both influencers and telehealth companies like Hims, Roe, and Teladoc, who may not have a direct financial connection to the makers of the drugs they're promoting. The issue has attracted attention from members of Congress. The power of social media and the deluge of misleading promotions has meant too many young people are receiving medical advice from influencers instead of their healthcare professional. Senators Dick Durbin of Illinois and Mike Braun of Indiana wrote the FDA in a February letter. A recently introduced bill from the senators would bring influencers and telehealth companies clearly under FDA's jurisdiction, requiring them to disclose risk and side effect information. The bill would also require drug makers to publicly disclose payments to influencers. It's asking the FDA to take a more serious stance with this kind of marketing, said Willis. They know it's happening, but they could be doing more. Our next article is titled, Emerging Drug Development Firm Selects Fitzsimmons as its Colorado Headquarters. Proximity to expertise, access to educated talent, among the attributes cited. Dated November 13, 2024. Refined Science, an emerging biosciences company working to transform precision drug development, has selected Fitzsimmons Innovation Community in Aurora as its Colorado headquarters. Fitzsimmons Innovation Community, an integrated campus of facilities for innovative health and life sciences companies, announced the agreement Wednesday. Refined Science already operates within the Fitzsimmons Innovation Community. With Wednesday's announcement, it will transition from the Foundry, a CU Innovations incubator housed in Bioscience 1, to permanent lab and office space in Bioscience 3. Refined Science aims to change the way data is used to improve patient outcomes. The company designs smarter clinical trials that can move previously stalled drugs through the clinical stage and on to market where they can start helping patients. Started as part of CU Innovations, Refined Science has evolved from a clinical decision support tool into a novel new precision medicine platform. The leadership team looked at other cities for life sciences incubation and development and ultimately chose Fitzsimmons Innovation Community to allow them to remain close to the team of experts they consult on the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus and to have custom lab space in the right size for their initial location, knowing that the room they need to grow is available to them when they're ready. With new hires on the horizon, a location in Colorado also gives them access to the highly educated talent pool for which the state is known. We were born out of this university, and we continue to have extremely strong ties to it, said Refined Science CEO Eric Johnson. We've obviously evolved and now have our own identity too, but we've learned that bringing the best of academia and the best of industry together can create the best company, so we never want to lose that connection. Kimberly Muller, Executive Director of CU Innovations and co-founder of Refined Science, said the presence of the emerging company strengthens CU Innovations' leadership in precision medicine. This endeavor is reshaping the very landscape of the clinical trial design, she said. Fitzsimmons Innovation Community has the infrastructure in place to support our bold approach, which promises to accelerate discoveries, propelling us toward tailored therapies that cater to the unique needs of each patient. Our next article is titled, Greg Maffei Stepping Down as CEO of Liberty Media. Cable cowboy John Malone returns as interim chief. Dated November 13, 2024. Greg Maffei is stepping down as president and CEO of Liberty Media. The company says the 64-year-old Maffei will leave his role when his contract expires at the end of the year and become an advisor. Liberty Media's 83-year-old chairman, John Malone, will be the interim CEO. While it's never easy to leave an organization as dynamic as Liberty, I'm confident that this is the right time, Maffei, 64, said in a statement released Wednesday. He was a leading figure in the takeover of Formula One in 2017 from longtime rights holder Bernie Ecclestone. At the time, Maffei predicted an enormous opportunity to grow the sport. The years since then have seen a boom in interest in F1, in part driven by the successes of the Netflix series Drive to Survive. That's particularly true in the United States, which now hosts three races a year. The Las Vegas Grand Prix is next week. Liberty Media said in August that it was under investigation by the U.S. Justice Department over denying Andretti Global's bid to become F1's 11th team. Maffei said at the time that the company is open to new entrants applying and potentially being approved if certain requirements are met. Liberty Media also expanded into motorcycle racing in April when it agreed a deal worth around $4.5 billion for the MotoGP series. Our next article is titled, Colorado No Longer a Top 10 State for Movers. State gaining more people from international migration than domestic. Dated October 2nd, 2024. The Common Sense Institute reports that Colorado is no longer a top 10 moving destination for those from other states. The Greenwood Village-based nonpartisan research organization released its findings Tuesday from an analysis of 2023 domestic migration data. Colorado's boom economy was built in large part on a booming population growth, said Colley Caulfield, CSI executive director. Colorado is no longer the destination it once was. It's no longer a top 10 spot for movers. It's gaining more people from international migration than from domestic migration. Key findings of the report include: Colorado is no longer a top 10 state for migration. Colorado ranked 16th for domestic plus natural population gain in 2023 out of 30 that had a net increase. It ranked in the top 10 through the 2010s, including second in the nation in 2015. In terms of domestic migration, of the nearly 900,000 people who moved states, 53% of those movers went to Florida, Texas, or North Carolina, with Florida and Texas each getting more than 20% of movers. Only 0.8% of the movers chose to move to Colorado. Colorado saw more of a net gain of Californians than any other state, nearly twice as many from the next highest state, Texas. Colorado lost more people to Nevada than any other state, followed by Oklahoma, Wyoming, and Arkansas. The state's total population increased by 36,000 people, reaching 5.87 million. This is 7,000 more people than in 2022, but less than half of the average growth between 2011 and 2020. The state gained more people by moving in than it did by births. The natural increase in the state's population, births minus deaths, was 17,400, 48% of growth. Colorado gained more people from international migration than domestic migration in 2022 and 2023. Colorado gained nearly 12,000 individuals from international migration. This is nearly three times higher than in 2021. Domestic migration increased slightly in 2023 to 7,200, just 16% of the average level of domestic migration between 2015 and 2019. Our next article is titled, McDonald's is investing $100 million to bring customers back after E. coli outbreak. Colorado reported at least 30 cases, dated November 17, 2024. McDonald's is investing $100 million to bring customers back to stores after an outbreak of E. coli food poisoning tied to onions on the fast food giant's Quarter Pounder hamburgers. The investments include $65 million that will go directly to the hardest hit franchises, the company said. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has said that slivered onions on Quarter Pounders were the likely source of the E. coli. Taylor Farms in California recalled onions potentially linked to the outbreak. Colorado reported at least 30 cases, Montana reported 19, Nebraska 13, and New Mexico 10. The illnesses were reported between September 12 and October 21. At least 104 people got sick and 34 were hospitalized, according to federal health officials. One person died in Colorado, and four people developed a potentially life-threatening kidney disease complication. The Food and Drug Administration has said there does not appear to be a continued food safety concern related to this outbreak at McDonald's restaurants, but the outbreak hurt company sales. Quarter Pounders were removed from menus in several states in the early days of the outbreak. McDonald's identified an alternative supplier for the 900 restaurants that temporarily stopped serving the hamburgers with onions. Over the past week, McDonald's resumed selling Quarter Pounders with slivered onions nationwide. Our next article is titled, Denver's Chris Wright Tapped as Trump's Energy Secretary. Liberty Energy founder and CEO deemed key pillar in quest for U.S. energy dominance. Dated November 17, 2024, by Matthew Daly, Will Weissert, and Colleen Long. Donald Trump has selected Chris Wright, CEO and founder of Denver-based Liberty Energy, to serve as Energy Secretary in the President-elect's second administration. Wright is a vocal advocate of oil and gas development, including fracking, a key pillar of Trump's quest to achieve U.S. energy dominance in the global market. He has been one of the industry's loudest voices against efforts to fight climate change and could give fossil fuels a boost, including quick action to end a year-long pause on natural gas export approvals by the Biden administration, frequently criticizing what he calls a top-down approach to climate by liberal and left-wing groups. Wright has argued that the climate movement around the world is collapsing under its own weight. He has never served in government, but has written that more fossil fuel production is needed around the globe to lift people out of poverty. Wright, a self-described tech nerd-turned-entrepreneur, earned his undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering at MIT and did graduate work in electrical engineering at UC Berkeley and MIT. In 1992, he founded Pinnacle Technologies. Innovations there helped launch commercial shale gas production and created an industry in hydraulic fracture mapping. Wright served as CEO of Pinnacle until 2006. He was chairman of Stroud Energy, an early shale gas producer, before selling to shale pioneer Range Resources in 2006. In 2010, Wright founded Liberty Resources. Consideration of Wright to head the administration's energy department won support from influential conservatives, including oil and gas tycoon Harold Hamm. Hamm, executive chairman of Oklahoma-based Continental Resources, a major shale oil company, is a longtime Trump supporter and advisor who played a key role on energy issues in Trump's first term. Hamm helped organize an event at Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in April, where Trump reportedly asked industry leaders and lobbyists to donate $1 billion to Trump's campaign, with the expectation that Trump would curtail environmental regulations if reelected. Mike Summers, president of the American Petroleum Institute, the oil and gas industry's top lobbying group, said Wright's experience in the energy sector gives him an important perspective that will inform his leadership of the Energy Department. We look forward to working with him, once confirmed, to bolster American geopolitical strength by lifting DOE's pause on LNG export permits and ensuring the open access of American energy for all our allies around the world. Jackie Wong, Senior Vice President for Climate and Energy at Natural Resources Defense Council, an environmental group, called Wright a champion of dirty fossil fuels and said his nomination to lead the Energy Department was a disastrous mistake. The Energy Department should be doing all it can to develop and expand the energy resources of the 21st century, not trying to promote the dirty fuels of the last century, Wong said. Given the devastating impacts of climate fuel disasters, DOE's core mission of researching and promoting cleaner energy solutions is more important now than ever. The Energy Department is responsible for advancing energy, environmental, and nuclear security of the United States. The agency is in charge of maintaining the country's nuclear weapons, oversees 17 national research laboratories, and approves natural gas exports, as well as ensuring environmental cleanup of the nation's nuclear weapons complex. It also promotes scientific and technological research. Republican Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming, who is expected to become chairman of the State Energy and Natural Resources Committee, said Trump promised bold choices for his cabinet, and Wright's nomination delivers. He's an energy innovator who laid the foundation for America's fracking boom. After 4 years of America's last energy policy, our country is desperate for a secretary who understands how important American energy is to our economy and our national security, Barrasso said. If confirmed, Wright will join North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, Trump's choice to be Interior Secretary, as a key player on energy policy in a second Trump term. Wright will be a member of a new National Energy Council that Burgum will chair. The new panel will seek to establish U.S. energy dominance around the world, Trump said. Thomas Pyle, president of the American Energy Alliance, a conservation group that supports fossil fuels, said Wright would be an excellent choice for Energy Secretary. Pyle led Trump's Energy Department's transition team in 2016. The announcement of Wright's selection came hours after a key Trump ally, billionaire Elon Musk, called for more direct public input into the decision-making process for another top post that the president-elect is still mulling, the head of his new administration's Treasury Department. Would be interesting to hear more people weigh in on this for Trump to consider feedback. Musk, who Trump has already tapped to co-lead a commission tasked with increasing government spending efficiency, posted Saturday on the X social media platform he owns. Musk used the rest of his post to become the first participant in the public poll he was proposing, endorsing Howard Lutnick, the CEO of financial services firm Cantor Fitzgerald, and co-chair of Trump's transition team, over hedge manager Scott Bessent. Musk said in his post that Bessent is a business-as-usual choice, whereas Lutnick will actually enact change. Business-as-usual is driving America bankrupt, so we need to change, he said. Both Lutnick and Bessent have been mentioned as possible picks to lead the Treasury Department. Bessent is considered the more conventional, business-friendly choice. He is skeptical about cryptocurrency, while Lutnick is friendlier to the crypto industry. Trump's pick to lead his Health and Services Department, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., also endorsed Lutnick, posting on his own X account, "Bitcoin is the currency of freedom, a hedge against inflation for middle-class Americans." Our next article is titled, "Spirit Airlines Filing for Bankruptcy as It Faces Looming Debt Payments." The company said customers and employees would not be impacted during the bankruptcy process. Dated November 18, 2024. Spirit Airlines announced on Monday that it is filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. One of the country's largest low-cost carriers, Spirit operates across 90 destinations in the U.S., Latin America, and the Caribbean. The company stated that it would continue to operate normally while restructuring its debt through the bankruptcy process. Guests can continue to book and fly without interruption and could use all tickets, credits, and loyalty points as normal, Spirit said in a press release on Monday. The company also confirmed that employees would continue to be paid throughout the process. The Associated Press reported that Spirit faced looming debt payments of more than $1 billion over the next year, following losses of $2.5 billion over the past 4 years. I'm pleased we have reached an agreement with the supermajority of both our loyalty and convertible bondholders on a comprehensive recapitalization of the company, which is a strong vote of confidence in Spirit and our long-term plan, said Ted Christie, Spirit's president and chief executive officer. This set of transactions will materially strengthen our balance sheet and position Spirit for the future while we continue executing on our strategic initiatives to transform our guest experience, providing new enhanced travel options, greater value, and increased flexibility. The bankruptcy announcement was foreshadowed last week. Spirit's stock plummeted more than 50% after the Wall Street Journal reported that the airline was preparing to file for bankruptcy. The bankruptcy filing follows at least two failed attempts to merge with other airlines. Frontier Airlines was first in line in 2022, but JetBlue eventually won in favor and was set to merge with Spirit. However, that merger fell through due to opposition from the federal government, which argued it violated antitrust laws. Spirit reportedly renewed efforts to merge with Frontier, but those negotiations were also unsuccessful. Our next article is titled, "Denver Restaurants Navigate the Cost of Minimum Wage Increases," dated November 17, 2024, by Maggie Walensky. Serving the Mile High City can be challenging. Still, for the past 9 years, Cuperta Italian Restaurant has become a neighborhood staple thanks to support from both new and old customers. We've been happy to make new regulars through the years, but certainly our regular business, our consistent business, is what keeps the doors open, said Paul Riley, culinary director of Cuperta. Coming up a decade of business, Cuperta has seen changes throughout the uptown neighborhood, along with changes to the cost of employment as Denver's minimum wage has increased. Back in 2020, the minimum wage is $12.85 per hour. Now in 2024, it's $18.29 and will go to $18.81 in 2025. We have definitely, over the years, been more prepared year after year for the minimum wage increases. It's something that we absolutely want to provide for our staff. It's something that we take pride in, Riley said. With a staff of around 20, Riley explained that part of navigating these costly challenges is planning ahead and reducing hiring. We employ less people these days, so we might be busier, but we have less people working in the restaurant, Riley said. In response to Denver's minimum wage increase, Sonia Riggs, president and CEO of the Colorado Restaurant Association, provided the following statement. It's been incredibly difficult for restaurant operators to absorb minimum wage increases over the past few years, on top of soaring costs for food, liquor, property taxes, utilities, and more. Denver's tipped minimum wage has risen almost 90% since 2019, and the non-tipped minimum wage is almost up 65%, leaving operators with less and less in an industry with historically thin margins. Noisette Restaurant and Bakery opened in August 2022. The owner, Lillian Liu, has seen firsthand the challenges of running the local spot. It's definitely been a bit of a struggle, just with the economy, and just struggling from coming out of the pandemic as well. We're dealing with a lot of inflation and wage hikes, Liu said. While the increases directly impact her business, Liu recalled the days when she made minimum wage and the need for restaurant employees to have livable salaries. The minimum wage hikes are definitely a positive thing for our industry in general. For a long time, our industry people have been severely underpaid. I used to work for $12 an hour in New York City and without any tips, Liu said. When dining at Noisette, Liu explained why there might be changes to menu prices as labor is their largest expense. I mean, restaurants run on super tight margins, and so people are sometimes confused about why things are priced the way they are, Liu explained. But there is a system in place where we recreate the price, and so when one part of the system is changed, we have to change the price. Even with the challenges of running local restaurants, Liu and Riley hope the community they love to serve will support them. We want to serve our community. We love what we're doing, and we hope that it's something that is appreciated, Liu explained. So that's why I think it's really important to support any small business in the area, especially like local independent-owned businesses. Our next article is titled, Hundreds of Hotel Workers Go on Strike at a Casino Near the Las Vegas Strip. Dated November 15, 2024. Hundreds of hotel workers at a casino near the Las Vegas Strip went on strike just before dawn Friday, after a long and highly publicized fight for a new contract. The strike at Virgin Hotels Las Vegas marks the first open-ended strike in 22 years for the Culinary Workers Union, the largest labor union in Nevada, with about 60,000 members. The union posted on the social platform X on Friday morning, Virgin Hotels Las Vegas Casino is on strike. Virgin Hotel workers are walking out right now at Virgin Las Vegas for a fair contract. Stand with the workers, do not cross the strike line. Workers at the casino also walked off the job for 48 hours earlier this year as negotiations escalated, hoping to pressure Virgin Hotels to create a new 5-year deal with wage increases and better benefits. Housekeepers, cocktail and food servers, porters, and bellhops were among those on the picket line Friday outside the hotel casino, which was formerly the Hard Rock Las Vegas. It comes exactly a year after casinos up and down the strip narrowly avoided tens of thousands of hospitality workers walking off the job on the weekend the city was set to host the first Formula One race on the famous boulevard. But agreements were reached just before the union's deadline for a strike, giving workers a roughly 32% salary increase over the life of the contract, including a 10% bump in pay in the first year. After the breakthrough deals last November, the Culinary Union quickly reached similar agreements for the rest of its members at major hotel casinos on the Strip, downtown, and at off-strip properties, with the exception of Virgin Hotels. The contracts on the Strip alone cover more than 40,000 workers. Bethany Kahn, A spokesperson for the union said Virgin Hotels is the final holdout. The union's contract covering about 700 employees there expired in June. The union says Virgin Hotels does not want to give its workers any wage increases during the first 3 years of a new five-year contract. "We are worth more than zero wage increases," Merla Paramo, a casino porter, said in a statement provided by the union. Virgin Hotels said Thursday in a statement that it had agreed to some wage increases before the fourth year of a new contract, but the union declined the proposal. Virgin Hotels did not provide specifics on its proposal. "Our dedication to our team members' well-being and achieving sustainable performance at our property remains steadfast, and we are fully committed to finding a fair resolution that is in their best interest," the statement reads. While Friday's walkout is far smaller in scale than the strikes planned for last year on the Strip, disruptions are still likely because of Virgin Hotels' location. The 1,500-room property is just off the Strip and along a common route to the tourist corridor from the city's international airport. The hotel casino sits on a recognizable lot where an 80-foot neon guitar sign stood for decades. It was removed in 2017 after the Hard Rock closed. Culinary union members last went on strike in 2002 for 10 days at the Golden Gate Hotel Casino in downtown Las Vegas. Our next article is titled, "Denver Business Turns Storefront into Co-op to Sell Local Products During Farmers Market Off-Season." Article dated November 12, 2024, by Maggie Walansky. Navigating through the winter months can be challenging for small business owners who rely heavily on sales through farmers markets. Rachel Dunhoff is hoping to use her storefront to alleviate some of that burden. A hobby for mushroom growing turned into a business for Dunhoff, who now owns Fox Fungi, an urban mushroom farm near downtown Denver that grows a variety of gourmet mushrooms, from oyster to Chautauqua mushrooms. "The first year, we were in four farmers markets. We did two on a Saturday and two on a Sunday," said Dunhoff. "We were reaching out to restaurants, bringing in samples. So we did have a little bit of a wholesale market. The first 2 years were really, really tough." Dunhoff still recalls the immense amount of community support that pushed them into the blooming mushroom business it is today. "We had a great year this year. There were some weeks we were up to 18 markets," said Dunhoff. "This year we expanded quite a bit, brought on some employees for the first time this year, tested some different areas that we haven't been in." The changing of the season marks the ends of farmers markets, with vendors saying goodbye to their regulars and each other. Dunhoff realized she could help her farmers market friends sell their goods during the off-season by filling the storefront of her business with local products. "We're not growing as much and had just started reaching out to some friends that we've had over the last few years and asked if they had an interest in joining us as more of a co-op, and I think everybody said yes," Dunhoff said. Now the shelves of her storefront are overflowing with local produce and goods from all around Denver metro area, thanks to the Farmer Fox and Friends Co-op. "What started as 20 vendors went to 30 and then went to 40, and we have over 60 small businesses now in about 4 weeks," Dunhoff said. Christina and Julian Salas, owners of Don Zorro's Molino, have their tortilla chips for sale inside the store. Christina said this concept will help generate revenue for her small business during a traditionally slow time. "We're trying to strategize how we do market that, how we do advertise that. And it just kind of starts with just one item in a place, and then it kind of trickles down from there," Christina said. The same message was echoed by Christopher Rice, owner of the mocktail company Cool as a Cucumber. "Just kind of getting the word out and now turning to something like Farmer Fox and Friends is awesome because it gives us an opportunity to be in people's hands and mouths that wouldn't be able to try us otherwise," he said. Looking at the full display at Farmer Fox and Friends, Dunhoff was moved to tears, recalling the special bond made on those days spent selling products at the farmers markets. "Normally, we're selling mycology supplies in the winter. And now we have a storefront of what looks like a little market," Dunhoff said. Despite the financial challenges that come in the off-season, this marketplace brings hope, along with a source of additional revenue, to local vendors by bringing their products into the hand of community members. Being a small business, obviously you go through a lot of highs, a lot of lows. And in those lows, it's trying to figure out how to get out of them sometimes, said Salas. When opportunities like the community that you have present itself, that really does say, okay, we're doing the right thing. We're where we should be, and we're enjoying what we're doing. Farmer Fox and Friends is located in the storefront of Fox Fungi at 2370 South Kalamath Street, Unit D in Denver. It's open every day from noon to 6 p.m. Our next article is titled, Japanese Automaker Nissan Cuts 9,000 Jobs as Its Vehicles Fail to Sell. Dated November 7, 2024. Nissan reported Thursday a loss for the latest fiscal quarter as its vehicle sales sank while costs and inventory ballooned, prompting the Japanese automaker to slash 9,000 jobs. Chief Executive Makoto Uchida said he was taking a 50% pay cut to take responsibility for the dismal results, while promising that a turnaround was coming. Nissan Motor Corp. announced a global workforce reduction of 9,000 people, or about 6% of its more than 133,000 employees, as well as a plan to slash global production by 20%. Uchida declined to say which regions will be affected by the cuts or give specifics. For the latest quarter through September, Nissan racked up a 9.3 billion yen, or $60 million, loss, a reversal from the 190 billion yen profit recorded the same quarter a year ago. Quarterly sales fell to 2.9 trillion yen, or $19 billion, from 3.1 trillion yen. Uchida acknowledged Nissan didn't respond quickly or flexibly enough to global changes, including market tastes and soaring raw material costs. "I take this situation very seriously," he told reporters. "Nissan will restructure its business to become leaner and more resilient." Nissan models did not sell well in the U.S., one of the most lucrative auto markets in the world that's recently been dominated by Ford, Toyota, and Tesla. "All aspects of Nissan's operations and plans will be under review," Uchida said. Nissan, based in the port city of Yokohama, reported fiscal first half sales revenue of 5.98 trillion yen, edging down 1% from the more than 6 trillion yen the same period last year. In April to September, profit totaled 19.2 billion yen, or $124 million, declining sharply from the 296.2 billion yen earned over the 6 months last year. Nissan lowered its sales revenue forecast for the fiscal year through March 2025 to $82 billion, from an earlier projection of $91 billion. It did not give a net profit forecast, citing uncertainty. It promised to give a profit forecast as soon as possible. Earlier, Nissan was forecasting an annual profit of about $1.9 billion. Nissan now expects to sell 3.4 million vehicles around the world in the fiscal year ending March 2025, down from an earlier projected 3.65 million vehicles. The new number is about the same that Nissan sold last fiscal year. Nissan said it's appointing a chief performance officer tasked with turnaround decision-making who will begin his job next month. No dividends will be paid out, given the harsh results. Our next article is titled, Median Affordable Housing Project in One Colorado Town Sees High Demand in First Minutes of Application Opening. Dated November 16, 2024. On the town of Erie's 150th anniversary, town officials launched applications for its first median affordable housing program. Within the first few minutes of applications opening, they already saw more applicants than the number of homes available to sell. This program aims to make living in Erie more affordable for people who work there through a median income housing project. Cheeseman Street residents' homes are expected to be in the $300,000 to $400,000 range, which is about half of the current median price for homes in Erie, right now about $770,000. The project for 35 affordable units comes from a partnership with the Town of Erie and the development group Vertical. As a managing partner with Vertical, Walker Thrash has been working on the Cheeseman Street residence for the past 2 years. It's important for us to work on things within our own neighborhoods and towns that are a public benefit, Thrash said, because everybody's looking at it on the table right now, trying to figure out, really, how do we deliver this type of product? Thrash credited the reality of this affordable project to funding and partnership from the town, state, and other organizations and grants. In the most sought-after towns and cities, that middle is disappearing faster, and that's where we are in Erie right now. So for us, it's important to try to develop a model with the town of... How can we tackle this problem? Thrash said. In the last 10 years, the town reports more than 10,000 people having moved there. Gabby Ray with the town of Erie says this project is to adapt to that growing population. As we grow, we need more commercial space, retail, we need restaurants, we need all these sorts of things. But we also need people to work there. And we'd love those people to live here. So having some more affordable places to live, to buy their homes, and be in our community is ideal for the people who can work in those spaces, she said. Those who are eligible for the units earn a total of 60% to 120% of the median income in Erie. For a family of four, that ranges from just about $90,000 to $175,000 a year, with exact numbers on the town's website. Ray says this is just part of a larger goal. We're trying to reach 12% affordable housing units in the city, and this really is a big step in helping us get there, she said. Before these are built, we're at less than 1%. We have very, very little affordability for purchase. While the town already has more than 50 applications for 35 units, people can still apply to show interest, as Vertical is expecting to work on another affordable project soon in a nearby city. Homes are still in the early construction stages, but applicants could be selected as soon as next month, with move-in in the middle of next year. Our next article is titled, Pay First, Deliver Later. Some women are being asked to prepay for their baby. Dated November 15, 2024. In April, just 12 weeks into her pregnancy, Kathleen Clark was standing at the receptionist window of her OBGYN's office when she was asked to pay $960, the total the office estimated she would owe after she delivered. Clark, 39, was shocked that she was asked to pay that amount during this second prenatal visit. Normally, patients receive the bill after insurance has paid its part, and for pregnant women, that's usually only when the pregnancy ends. It would be months before the office filed the claim with her health insurer. Clark said she felt stuck. The Cleveland, Tennessee obstetrics practice was affiliated with a birthing center where she wanted to deliver. Plus, she and her husband had been wanting to have a baby for a long time. And Clark was emotional because just weeks earlier her mother had died. You're standing there at the window, and there's people all around, and you're trying to be really nice, recalled Clark through tears. So I paid it. On online baby message boards and other social media forums, pregnant women say they are being asked by the providers to pay out-of-pocket fees earlier than expected. The practice is legal, but patient advocacy groups call it unethical. Medical providers argue that asking for payment up front ensures they get compensated for their services. How frequently this happens is hard to track because it is considered a private transaction between the provider and the patient. Therefore, the payments are not recorded in insurance claims data and are not studied by researchers. Patients, medical billing experts, and patient advocates say the billing practice causes unexpected anxiety at a time of already heightened stress and financial pressure. Estimates can sometimes be higher than what a patient might ultimately owe and force people to fight for refunds if they miscarry or the amount paid was higher than the final bill. Upfront payments also create hurdles for women who may want to switch providers if they are unhappy with their care. In some cases, they may cause women to forego prenatal care altogether, especially in places where few other maternity care options exist. It's holding their treatment hostage, said Caitlin Donovan, a senior director at the Patient Advocate Foundation. Medical billing and women's health experts believe OBGYN offices adopted the practice to manage the high cost of maternity care in the way it is billed for the U.S. When a pregnancy ends, OBGYNs typically file a single insurance claim for routine prenatal care, labor, delivery, and often postpartum care. That practice of bundling all maternity care into one billing code began 3 decades ago, said Lisa Satterfield, Senior Director of Health and Payment Policy at the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. But such bundled billing has become outdated, she said. Previously, pregnant patients had been subject to co-payments for each prenatal visit, which might lead them to skip crucial appointments to save money. But the Affordable Care Act now requires all commercial insurers to fully cover certain prenatal services. Plus, it's become more common for pregnant women to switch providers or have different providers handle prenatal care, labor, and delivery, especially in rural areas where patient transfers are common. Some providers say prepayments allow them to spread out one-time payments over the course of the pregnancy to ensure that they are compensated for the care they do provide, even if they don't ultimately deliver the baby. You have people who, unfortunately, are not getting paid for the work that they do, said Pamela Boatner, who works as a midwife in a Georgia hospital. While she believes women should receive pregnancy care regardless of their ability to pay, she also understands that some providers want to make sure their bill isn't ignored after the baby is delivered. New parents might be overloaded with hospital bills and the costs of caring for a new child, and they may lack income if a parent isn't working, Boatner said. In the U.S., having a baby can be expensive. People who obtain health insurance through large employers pay an average of nearly $3,000 out of pocket for pregnancy, childbirth, and postpartum care, according to the Peterson KFF Health System Tracker. In addition, many people are opting for high-deductible health insurance plans, leaving them to shoulder a larger share of the costs. Of the 100 million U.S. people with health care debt, 12% attribute at least some of it to maternity care, according to a 2022 KFF poll. Families need time to save money for the high cost of pregnancy, childbirth, and child care, especially if they lack paid maternity leave, said Joy Burkhart, CEO of the Policy Center for Maternal Mental Health, a Los Angeles-based policy think tank. Asking them to prepay is another gut punch, she said. What if you don't have the money? Do you put it on credit cards and hope your credit card goes through? Calculating the final costs of childbirth depends on multiple factors, such as the timing of the pregnancy, planned benefits, and health complications, said Aaron Duffy, a health policy researcher at the University of Southern California's Schaefer Center for Health Policy and Economics. The final bill for the patient is unclear until the health plan decides how much of the claim it will cover, she said. But sometimes the option to wait for the insurer is taken away. During Jamie Dawes' first pregnancy in 2020, her OBGYN accepted her refusal to pay in advance because Daw wanted to see the final bill. But in 2023, during her second pregnancy, a private midwifery practice in New York told her that since she had a high deductible plan, it was mandatory to pay $2,000 spread out with monthly payments. Daw, a health policy researcher at Columbia University, delivered in September 2023 and got a refund check that November for $640 to cover the difference between the estimate and the final bill. I study health insurance, she said, but as most of us know, it's so complicated when you're really living it. While the Affordable Care Act requires insurers to cover some prenatal services, it doesn't prohibit providers from sending their final bill to patients early. It would be a challenge politically and practically for state and federal governments to attempt to regulate the timing of the payment request, said Sabrina Corlett, a co-director of the Center on Health Insurance Reforms at Georgetown University. Medical lobbying groups are powerful, and contracts between insurers and medical providers are proprietary. Thank you for joining us for the Colorado Business Digest, read by Michael Hesser.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.